And so to tonight's lecture, we're very lucky to have George McFarlane from the University of Dundee. George graduated from the University of Dundee in 1984 and then took up a position at the Dunn Clinical Nutrition Centre in Cambridge, where he established a laboratory to study the metabolic activities of gut microorganisms, principally in relation to dietary fibre, resistant starches, proteins and hydrogen. Subsequent investigations in Cambridge involved work on microbial biofilms in the gut and the role of mucosal bacteria in inflammatory bowel disease. In 1999, George returned to the University of Dundee, to the medical school, where his research has focused on inflammatory bowel disease and ageing, something that's of increasing interest for several of us, and also microbial invasion of the upper gut. Needless to say, he is a member of the editorial board of JAM and has first joined it, I understand, in 1987, but he's also a member of the society, as well as several other learned societies, including the Pathological Society, and a fellow of the Society of Biology and the Royal Society of Medicine. So without more ado, I'll hand the mic over to George.
Evening, everyone, Mr. Chairman. Before I begin, I would just like to thank SFAM for inviting me to come and give the lecture here tonight. I feel very honoured to be but the second person to do that. So thank you very much. Now, what I'm going to talk about tonight, I'm going to try and give a broader view of the gut and bacterial metabolism there, rather than focusing down on some narrow areas. And what I plan is to start off looking at the amount of bacteria that's in the gut, and then focusing on carbohydrate and protein metabolism. Then I'll move on to hydrogen, and then aging, and just towards the end I'll do a bit on gut modelling, just to show you how useful it can be in some instances. So without any more ado, I'll go for the first slide. Now, many of you, or some of you at least, will have read that there's a kilogram or even a kilogram and a half bacteria in the large bowel. Sadly, this is a complete fallacy, as this slide shows you. What we have here is results of a series of studies made over 25 years on human sudden death victims in Cambridge and in Soweto, South Africa. These samples were very difficult to get hold of at the time and are completely impossible now. We looked at 46 people. This is the amount of intestinal contents in grams. And this is total gut contents. So you see this is effectively fecal material. And you can see that not only is there not a kilogram of bacteria, it's only a couple of hundred grams of fecal material. And bacteria only constitute about 40 to 50% of fecal material. This is the range here, okay? 57 to 904 grams. 904 sounds quite good, except that was one person, one outlier, and he hasn't even skewed the data, so I've left him. If you look at bacterial cell mass, so if you fraction stool, we find there's only about 40 or 50 grams of bacteria, and that's the way it's there. In a way, this makes the gut microbiota a lot more exciting, because you have all this metabolism going on with a lot less bacteria than most people think. Now, recent sequencing studies have shown that when I get used to this sooner or later, just trust me, there's about 3 million genes in the gut microbiome compared to only about 23,000 in the human microbiome. And this corresponds to about 1,000 bacteria. Some of the more wild sequencers will tell you there's 3,500 bacteria, or there's 3,500 different sequences in the gut. Maybe, probably. So there's 150 times more genes in the microbiome than there is associated with somatic cells in the body. Many of these genes have been shown to be completely new, and for the most part we don't know what they do. But the implication is that they encode for considerable metabolic diversity. Now, I'm about to talk very much about feces here. Little to do with protein or carbohydrate, but I wanted to put them in just to give you some idea of the diversity of bacterial processes that are going on in the gut. It's not just protein breakdown, it's not just carbohydrate breakdown. Although, they drive everything else we see to a large extent. I don't plan to go through all these, less people at the bar won't be able to read them anyway. But if you look at some of the activities here, steroid and bile acid metabolism, we detoxify mutagens, modify xenobiotics, stimulate their intrahepatic circulation, which can have deleterious health effects on those. And they're also involved in ligand and phycoestrogen metabolism, which have hormone-like qualities in humans. Some other genotoxics, or some genotoxic substances, phytopentanes produced by bacteroides. We can detect these mutagens in 70% of stools in the UK. And it's not surprising, bacteroides by themselves constitute approximately 30% of all bacteria in the human gut. And then we go into azole compounds, secondary bile acids, and so on. What I'm trying to get over is that there's a whole load of processes going on here. There's some more aromatic hydrocarbons, N-nitrosyl compounds involved in cancer. But I will be talking about phenols, indoles, ammonia, and amines. Okay, so what are the factors that affect bacterial metabolism in the colon? Well, I have sample amotagly split them into host and bacterial. You can see for yourself here the main things. I'm going to touch on age later and diet. Now, diet is probably the most important driving force in regulating the structure and the metabolic activities of the colonic microbiota. If we look at the bacterial factors, obviously the types and amounts of bacteria that are there, not only do they affect what's going on, but they also affect the ingress of other species. Competition for nutrients in space, effectively, that's colonization resistance. And metabolic cooperation. Metabolic cooperation is important because there are many complex molecules available for bacteria to break down in the gut. Mucins are a good example. There are very heterogeneous molecules, and no single bacterium has the enzymic machinery to break them down on their own. So it requires the concerted efforts have many different bacteria to make these mucins available to other organisms. And these are the major substances bacteria grow on: starches, fats, or polysaccharides. That's dietary fiber. Oligosaccharides are increasingly being incorporated into the diet, and then there's proteins and peptides that escape digestion. The host, about 4 grams of pancreatic endopeptidases, go into the large bowel every day, and most of these are broken down by the bacteria. In fact, the large intestine is probably the most proteolytic natural environment we know. Mucus, I've touched on, epithelial cells, or the epithelium turns over about once every 6 days. So these dead cells go into the gut lumen and they're colonized by bacteria. But we can still find them in feces, depending on transit time. Put some numbers on this. The major sources of carbon and energy are resistant starches and the non-starch polysaccharides. All the others make significant contributions, and they're the drivers. Incidentally, one of the things which is important for maintaining species diversity in the colon is the diversity of carbon and energy sources that are available for the bacteria. So I just showed you that starch is probably the single most important carbohydrate. And if you look at these gut contents from sudden death victims, this is work by one of the best carbohydrate chemists there was, Hans Engels. He looked at the composition of glucose in the proximal bowel and in the distal bowel. And you can see in the cecum, predominantly starch, some non-cellulosic polysaccharide glucose and glucose. And in the sigmoid rectum, all of them have been broken down to some degree, leaving a residue in distal colon contents. Now this looks really complicated, and I'm not going to go through it, you'll be delighted to know. If we just look at how these things are metabolized, fructized, so this is things like inulin and starch, plant storage materials, NSP, they're metabolized in the PPP and the glycolytic pathway. Both through PEP and pyruvate. Pyruvate's probably the major control point in metabolism. And the major end products are the fatty acids, acetate, propionate, and butyrate. We can also find some of these fermentation intermediates, like succinate, methane's an end product, hydrogen sulfide, and lactate. Lactate form the ethanol and succinate. They're usually metabolized by cross-feeding organisms in the ecosystem. So their concentrations, for example, in stool, are usually quite low. If we look at energy generation from SCFA, there's been a lot of interest in energy generation due to obesity and looking at microbiotas and lean and obese people. I can never really get my hand around how bacteria were involved in this. Most people tend to think it was due to fatty acids, but they just don't provide enough energy to be responsible for someone being obese as opposed to somebody being lean. And in vitro fermentation studies indicate that based on 40 grams of netable carbohydrate, that should generate about 250 millimoles of SCFA. And if you look at arteriovenous differences in patients who are undergoing emergency surgery, and a lot of this data came from South Africa, from Soweto Township, where there's quite a high degree of violence and knifings, and the surgeons here were able to get portable bloods. These data suggest there's about 400 millimoles SCFA produced per day, which is about 5% of the host's daily requirements. So it's not a lot for people living on Western-style diets. But as I always say to people, it could mean life and death for people who are starving in some third world countries. Now, we look at SCFA. It's a sudden death victim stuff, material from the proximal and distal colons. This is the amount we find, about 125 millimoles per kilogram. That equates to millimolar for all practical purposes. And this goes down to slightly less than 100 in the distal colon as the SCFA are being absorbed. And in fact, about 95% of all fatty acids produced are absorbed from the large bowel and the metabolized host. These are molar ratios here. And the thing which interested me, this was measurements I personally made myself when I was discovering the GC a number of years ago. The others are mainly branched-chain fatty acids. I could never understand, based on these spot measurements, why the molar ratios were similar. Because substrate's going to be changing all the time, not only in the absolute amounts, but the types of substrate that are available to the bacteria as you go through the large bowel. So what we did was we took intestinal contents from these sudden death victims and just incubated them with no added substrate. They were incubated anaerobically for 48 hours. We then had a look at SCFA production. And you can see there was about 5 times more fatty acids produced in the proximal gut compared to the distal colon. So that proved that the proximal bowel was a very metabolically active area. And if you look at the molar ratios, just draw your attention to butyrate here. 7% versus 30%. So there's virtually no butyrate produced in the distal bowel. And the significance of that hopefully should become clear a bit later on. Now, this study showed you some in vitro fermentation experiments in pH-controlled stirred fermenters with 4 different carbohydrate polysaccharide sources. So these were separate fermenters. The yellows, the backbone sugars, and the reds are the side chain sugars of the polysaccharide. If you look at the yellow, the backbones first, you see that starch is broken down very rapidly, followed by pectin, and so this is uric acid actually, and the lactose in a rather long lactam, and the xylose is broken down more slowly. So different polysaccharides are broken down at different rates, and this can have significant effects on the types of fermentation acids that are produced. Because if something's broken down quickly, more fermentable carbohydrate becomes available rapidly, and this means that bacteria can start dumping off energy into electron sinks. Whereas if carbon is limiting, they prefer to produce acetate. So acetate production is linked, in bacteria, linked to energy generation. What I've said is borne up here. These are the molar ratios of acetate, propionate, and butyrate. Just draw your attention to the fact that acetate is the major fermentation product in xylene pectin. That starch was particularly associated with butyrate production. This is a human study done by Charles et al., where they fed human volunteers either resistant starch or soya fiber diets. And they looked for either acetate or lactate, D-lactate, in peripheral bloods. and you can lactate, incidentally, it's a precursor for butyrate formation. So that's probably where the butyrate and the starch fermentations are coming from. So these are produced by centrophic species. Anyway, you can see that you can even find the lactate in peripheral blood. Very little of this electron sink formed from the material. The reason that D-lactate is about this is that it's not metabolized very well by the human body, unlike L-lactate. And that's why some children have problems with D-lactate acidosis. So what happens to these fatty acids? Okay, here's a colon, liver, heart, brain, and this is meant to be peripheral tissues. These are acetate, propionate, and butyrate molar ratios. Look at the colon, APB 57:21:21, average. However, in the portal bay, note that butyrate is cleared to a significant extent. If you compare propionate in the portal vein, 25 versus 14, you can see that propionate is largely cleared to again to a major extent in the liver. And by the time we get to the brain and peripheral tissues, acetate predominates. And what it's showing you is that different fatty acids produced by different bacteria in the large bowel are cleared in different body organs. Right, this is another one of these slides where probably only the people in the front can see. So I'll focus on this. Acetate is metabolized in the heart, kidney, and brain, which are more or less just seen. It's also linked to caloric function. It stimulates smooth muscle contractions and peristalsis. It's involved in the immune system in a variety of ways. It's involved in laying down fat and also in carcinogenesis, where it stimulates natural killer cells, which in some circumstances may be protective against tumor formation. Propionate and butyrate, I suppose, are a bit more interesting. Propionate is also involved in immune system control. Carcinogenesis stimulates apoptosis in some cancer cells. Importantly, it increases satiety. It lowers cholesterol, and this was a funny one to me, it also has neurological effects similar to those seen in human autism. Although this one, I have to say, is fairly early. I think it's fair to say that probably the most interest in SCFA has been in butyrate over many, many years. And that interest is still ongoing. And the interest is mainly focused on carcinogenesis, colonic function, and immune system reactivity. But basically, butyrate is believed to be... Now this is from IMO and in neutral studies with satellites. Butyrate has been shown to inhibit cancer formation at a number of levels. And I mentioned histone-DSH. One of the original ways it was thought to be protective was through histone-DSH. And the idea was that it stimulates the enzyme, which opens up DNA to repair enzymes. Interestingly, Bill Rodinger showed that butyrate was the principal energy source for the colonic epithelium, and approximately 70% of the gut's energy comes from butyrate, particularly in the distal gut. And it's also a utilization of glutamine as well, but given the choice, the gut will take the butyrate. So we have an interesting situation here where the guts evolved to use a bacterial waste product as its principal source of energy. And butyrate, because it effectively drives the colonic mucosa. It's also involved in peristalsis and the movement of material through the gut. Okay, so now we move on to protein. Well, major products of protein breakdown, like that carbohydrate, are short-chain fatty acids and other organic acids such as succinate and lactate. It's also a precursor for methane, CO2, and hydrogen. In addition to these standard fermentation products, if you like, several unique products of metabolism are derived only from protein, and you can see them here. So BCFA are branched-chain fatty acids, which come from branched-chain amino acids. Phenols and indoles arise from aromatic amino acids, so phenylalanine, tyrosine, and tryptophan. Ammonia is produced in decarboxylation reactions, and it's a mutagen and cellular poison. And the reason it's a mutagen is that it speeds up cell proliferation, and it's thought to make epithelial cells more susceptible to eugenesis. But it is quite a nasty substance. I haven't got time to go into it in detail, but there used to be some strange operations carried out in the 50s and 60s, bypassing urine through the large bowel, and about half of them ended up with cancer. And that's because the urea has been broken down into ammonia. But they stopped doing these operations a while ago. Amines formed by decarboxylation, and they're very interesting metabolically. And of course, H2S and thiols arise from sulfur containing amino acids such as cysteine and thymine. Can you see okay? Yeah, I just stopped getting your way. Right. So, physiological effects resulting from protein breakdown. They're primarily seen in diets where there's low in carbohydrate or there's a long intestinal transit time. And low carbohydrates, that situation, certainly in the West, normally occurs in the distal bowel because saccharolytic bacteria have broke down the readily available carbohydrates in the proximal gut. But proteins and peptides are broken down much more slowly. And long caloric transit times, well, they range in the UK typically from about 20 to 120 hours, and the mean's about 60 to 70. So there's an enormous range, but it plays an important role in bacterial metabolism. There's a whole lot of symptoms there, and they were recognised back at the turn of the 20th century. And so much so, there was a British surgeon called Arbuthnot Lem, Sir Arbuthnot Lem. And he used to have a lot of very rich patients who were obviously on very refined diets, who would go and complain to him about these symptoms. And he used to recommend removal of the colon. So total colectomy to get rid of these symptoms. I think it was quite rich. I don't want to spend too much time on this. I just want to show you that as with different carbohydrates, different amino acids, so there's a range here, give rise to different fermentation acids. So from glutamate, acetate, and butyrate, from threonine, protein. So the basic principle is the same. Now, branched-chain fatty acids are quite interesting. They're excellent markers of fatty acid production from proteins. As I mentioned earlier, they arise from these branched-chain amino acids, and they're typically one carb London shorter than the parent university. In vitro modelling studies, measurements of fatty acids in emergency surgery cases show that about 30% of these, 30% of all fatty acids arising from protein are branched chain fatty acids. And this allows us to calculate that in the proximal colon, about 17% of all SCFA arise from protein. And this rises to about 38% in the distal bowel. So we can see this change from carbohydrate to protein digestion by bacteria as we move around the bowel. This shows you the effects of, this is some more of these batch culture studies. Use a pH controlled stir fermenter with fecal bacteria under anaerobic conditions. Samples are taken over time. And we can calculate the amount of BCFA, so these are specific rates of formation over time. And we looked at them under pH 6.8, 5.5, 6.8 plus a fermentable carbohydrate source. Why look at 6.8 and 5.5? Well, the pH, because of carbohydrate fermentation, is quite acid in the proximal well, probably about 5.2 to about 6. And this progressively arises as we go through the gut until it approaches neutrality in the distal colon. So these are the absolute values. But what I'd like to show you is in the proximal colon, under acid conditions, this is the only thing that's different. Your production was reduced by 82%. And if you increase, if you reduce the fermentable carbohydrate source, it's reduced by about a third. So these are the conditions that you would find in the proximal bowel. And it explains why we find so, that's the reason we find less protein breakdown products accumulating in the proximal bowel. And the reason for the starch doing this is that Saccharomyces bacteria grow on the starch. And they have a requirement for the building blocks of amino acids, because many of them would prefer to assimilate BCFA, ammonia or hydrogen sulfide and build their own amino acids. So they have a biosynthetic requirement for them. And these are So I'm moving on to phenols now. So these are the memo to the AV people. When you have somebody who's not very good with his hands, you've got to get a bigger controller. Preferably one that can use like a machine. Okay, so these are the three aromatic amino acids. Importantly, phenol and paracrysol arise from tyrosine. And these are probably the most toxic phenolic fermentation products. Products of phenylalanine are fairly benign, although I haven't shown it there, you can also get some paracrysol. And the tryptophan stuff, I think, is a bit up in the air. Some people think they're potentially toxic, some people say they're not. So I'm not going to jump in. So here's some data on the number of bacteria that can break down these substances. And we use an old technique, most probable number. Many of you will never have heard of it. It's very good for looking at any bacterial product you can think of. But basically, you have a series of tubes or a microtanker plate. you dilute up your sample as you would normally do, and instead of looking for the bacteria, you look for the metabolic product that you're looking for. And then this gives you an idea of the size of these populations. And if we look at, so here's total anaerobes, total pheno window producers. Just focus on the mean. 10.6 is what, nearly 10 times less than the total anaerobic count. So that's 10 times less bacteria able to produce these than there are total anaerobes in stools. And here's a range of some of the major phenols. And what I want to draw your attention to is if you look in the proximal and distal colon, so sudden death victim work, it's considerably more in the distal colon than in the proximal colon. And particularly paracrysome and phenol. Now, hopefully, you'll be able to see this. It's not too bright. Ideally, I would have liked to get this to the end when I'm talking about modeling, but this was a good place to put it in. We do a lot of modeling in the gut, basically doing things that we can't do in humans, we do in vitro. And a system that was developed a number of years ago is this three-stage model. So it's vessel 1, vessel 2, and vessel 3. And vessel 1 is fed from this medium reservoir and sequentially feeds vessels 2 and 3. And the idea is that we can simulate the pH conditions and the utilization, the utilization of nutrients as we go through the system to model the proximal and distal colons. And of course, these systems are good because you can vary just about any parameter you want. You can introduce toxic substances, anything. And we looked at phenol production, retention time of 27 hours or 67. Retention time equates to caloric transit time. And as I mentioned to you earlier, 20 is fast, 60 to 70 is about average. And the first thing you can see in vessel 1, so this is meant to simulate the sequence across the colon, very little phenol production, increases in vessel 2. This is meant to be the transverse, and in vessel 3 is the distal colon. But look, there's very little phenol accumulating. When we slow down the transit time in the distal bowel contents, you can see, particularly in vessel 3, we really start to get paracrysol and phenol accumulating. And it's exactly what we saw in spot measurements from sudden death victim contents. We'll march on to Aries now. These are the sort of concentrations you find in stools. So the mean was about 13 millimolar. Interestingly, if we look at MDX for the total Aries producers versus anaerobes, they're exactly the same. What's this telling us? Well, virtually all anaerobic bacteria in the gut are capable of producing amines. These are the main amines we find in the gut. These are amino acid progenitors, and most of them are produced by decarboxylation reactions. Amine and phenol production in these stirred batch culture fermenters. Again, pH 8, pH 5.5, and starch, phenols, and amines. And again, as with the BCFA, we see major effects of acid and carbohydrate availability. So, quick summary of carbohydrate and protein fermentation. So, carbohydrate fermentation stimulates bacterial growth bacterial cell mass, unstructured fatty acids stimulate peristalsis and move substances through the gut faster. And that's something we want to see. SCFA stimulates epithelial cell growth, mentioned that, responsible for gas production, could be good, in most cases it's bad. Good thing, it reduces products of protein breakdown. Proteins and peptides, toxic metabolites linked, number of disease states and cytotoxicity, we also get gas, and SCFA. Go on to hydrogen. Hydrogen is produced, so about 0.5 to 4 liters of hydrogen produced in the bowel each day. Most of it's lost in breath and flakes. However, much of it's cross-fed by other species, including methanogens, sulfur-reducing bacteria, nitrate reducers, and acidogens. And see where the hydrogen grows, and the end products are methane, harmless gas, toxic hydrogen sulfide, toxic nitrite, or beneficial acetate. There's very little denitrification air sails on. It's all nitrate dissimulation. Now, hydrogen production, apart from its obvious effects for bloating and the like, is also, it controls SCFA metabolism. And you can see the role here. If you add an external electron acceptor, such as either nitrate or sulfate. So these are controlled incubations for fecal bacteria. And if you remember that butyrate and lactate are electron sinks, so bacteria produce them when they've got too much energy. In contrast, when they're short of energy, they switch their metabolism to acetate when they can, generating more ATP. So if you look at the effects of nitrate, wipes out lactate accumulation and markedly reduces butyrate. Acetate increases. Same thing happens here. Lactate wiped out, butyrate reduced, acetate increases. Basically, what these thermoelectron acceptors do, they allow the bacteria to switch from fermentation, which is a very inefficient form of energy generation, to a form of respiratory metabolism, and they can generate more energy. And this just, we won't spend too long on this. This is acetogenesis, dissimilatory sulfate production, methanogenesis, and dissimilatory nitrate. If you just look, you can see that sulfate reduction is energetically the most favorable. Now, a number of years ago, we were very interested in methanogens and SRB in the gut. This was work done in Cambridge. We did a study where we looked at SRB and methanogens in stools, and we had 87 volunteers. And we looked at reduction rates, sulfate reducer counts, and breath. Oh, this is, so, sorry, that's dropped out. So 87 dollars. In group 1 and group 2, see that sulfur reduction rates were minimal, but they were high in group 3. This was mirrored by SRB counts, so these were log counts, and they were highest in group 3. Breath methane, 24-23, not detected in people carrying the sulfate reducers. And methane production rates, high, virtually the same in both groups, and not detected in the SRB group. So this was done in, just in Cambridge, and by far the biggest group carried high levels of these SRB. Now, this was a study done by Stefan Christel based on that work. And what they did was they got three volunteers. So this was from group two. So these were the switchers. You know, they had some SRBs that were mainly methanogens. And then they took the effect of diet. So they fed sulfate, 5 millimoles, 3 times per day meals. And they looked at breath methane and SRB counts in the stools. These are the days of the trial. Volunteer one, his methane production dropped during the sulfate feeding, increasing back during the washout period. Same in volunteer two, overshooting slightly. And again, volunteer three was virtually completely wiped out. And it came back. The point of this is that a small change in the diet can have big metabolic effects on some bacterial populations in the gut. And as you can see, these are here. These are often quite temporary. Basically, these people have changed from being methane producers, to producing sulfide in their gut. And you can do that quite nicely with beer, some of those brews. The SRB rates, so total reduction rates, shot up and then went back to the original. So the colon's a reservoir for dietary sulfate, and I'm going to focus on SRBs now. Sulfide can come from proteins or from sulfate in the diet. Sulfate can be incorporated directly into the mucin, and intestinal bacteria break down the mucin and sulfide, which can then be absorbed or undergo biosynthesis. This is a mucin molecule. Mucosal surfaces are coated with mucin throughout the body. It has a protective function, and it's also a lubricant. Mucins consist of a protein core and oligosaccharide side chains. And they come from the protein core in a bottle brush arrangement. So these are the different sugars, and there are a number of sulfate groups attached. Sulfate can account for 5 to 8% by weight of human colonic mucin. And the sulfates there is a block to stop bacterial glycosidases getting at these glycosidase linkages and breaking down the oligosaccharide chains too quickly. The bacteria produce carbohydrates, sulfatases, of course, and make this sulfate available for SRBs. And these are fecal sulfide concentrations in stool runs. In SRB positive and negative people, these are low SRB counts. And the main thing is, there's a trend between high rates of sulfate reducing carnage and high rates of fecal sulfide. Why is sulfide interesting? It's poison. Inhibits butyrate oxidation in colonocytes, inhibits phagocytosis, and also induces hyperproliferation similar to ammonia. Hydrogen sulfide is also being linked to colon cancer and to ulcerative colitis, not Crohn's, but to ulcerative colitis. And this just shows you photographs of human cancer. So this is taken during endoscopy, the bubbles being cleared out. And it's interesting to speculate that this may be due to the hyperproliferative effects of the sulfide. I think the case is slightly more stronger for having a lower UC, as it applies. Yeah, this is an endoscopy. hemiscopic picture, bubbles being cleared out, and you can see intestinal inflammation. This is one of the effects of severe UC. It's a colon being completely removed, and the inflammation has gone right from the distal bowel, right around transverse, and into the proximal colon. So it can be quite a devastating disease. If we look at SRB, what's the link between them and UC? Well, if you look at mucosal cuts in males and females, UC generally look healthy, no difference in females. But there was a log difference, a log increase in the males. So it's 10 times more SRB on its own going to be responsible for the disease? Probably not. This is a transverse section of the biopsy, stained with either DAPI, which is a general nucleic acid stain. This is the mucus layer, and it's filled with bacteria. This is a mucosa and the epithelial cell nuclei, if you like. This is a size three-stained probe looking for SRBs, and you can see them quite nicely in the mucus layer. So we can visualize SRBs in these people. So if I'm slightly questioning whether SRB on their own can be involved in UC initiation, there is a possible way of doing that outcome. The body produces three major detoxifying enzymes: proteinase, sulfur oxidase. Now you find these in the mucosa, in the liver, and in some of the blood cells. This is real-time PCR measurements of chronic tissue, and just look at the distal colon. So UC always initiates, always, without any doubt, in the distal colon, and then can't progress proximally on the bowel. Look at the distal colon, significantly lowered sulfide detoxifying enzymes. Could this explain why we link SRB to UC? But you may say, well, the tissue is damaged. It's not going to be working the same anyway. But these were standardized against GAP pH, which is present in all cells, glyceraldehyde 3 dehydrogenase. So we're looking at a specific effect on these enzymes. I think what I'll do is, I'm running out of time here, I'll miss the agent and go on to the model. As I mentioned to you earlier, there's a number of model systems used to study intestinal bacteria. We focus a lot on the sudden death victims. But the best model, of course, is healthy human volunteers. This, of course, limits us to what we can do with them. In terms of in vitro work, we focused on these continuous cultures over many years. And this just shows you that three-stage model, it should be a lot clearer in that scale. And this is a colon, so a meter and a half long, being removed at autopsy and opened up. This is the cecum ascending, transverse, descending, and sigmoid rectum here. So this area is the proximal bowel, and that's the distal bowel. And that's what we try to model using this system. So just to show you again, that's vessel 1, vessel 2, and vessel 3. I'll show you some really interesting, I think it's really interesting data from that. Fecal bacteria were grown in the model, and they were fed a diet comprising basically complex polysaccharides. So no simple carbohydrates, protein and some peptides. And the bacteria were going at these different retention times. And we looked at specific rates of carbohydrate utilization, and we called QSs. So they're specific milligrams per dry weight from bacteria per day. You can see if you compare the, first of all, the vessel ones, very high rates of carbohydrate utilization at the fast growth rates. As you slow down the growth rate, the specific rates of utilization of complex carbohydrates by the bacteria slows down. Although the overall percentage utilized has increased because there's more time, they have a greater residence in the fermentation vessel. And then, of course, as carbohydrate becomes depleted, the rates of carbohydrate utilization go down, because in both retention times, and we've got virtually the same amount of carbohydrate utilized at the end in vessel 3. This is the same experiment where we looked at the amounts of carbohydrate utilized, SCFA produced, and the conversion of carbohydrate to SCFA. So this is of significance to bacterial energy generation and generation, energy generation for those. And yeah, if you look at the vessel one, carbohydrate utilized in 24 hours is considerably less than at 67 hours. Now, here's the key thing. Look at the conversion, 67% versus 45%. And the reason for this is that when bacteria are growing slower, they have much higher maintenance energy requirements. Maintenance energy is the energy the organism requires just to exist and grow. For it to take in substrates and excrete waste products. And overall, the slower growth rate, you get a low versus a high carbohydrate conversion. And that's really important. So fast transits, rapid movement of material through the bowel, large amounts of substrate available in the cecum, all stimulate bacterial energy conversion. Second last slide you'll be delighted to know. This is my sort of concept of the gut microbiota and its metabolism. And at first glance, it looks like it's all over the place. But I'll just take you through. What I've got here, three trophic levels of bacteria. So primary carbohydrate degraders, secondary carbohydrate degraders. So these are cyclopathic bacteria that cross feed on polymer breakdown products generated by this trophic level. And in fact, these organisms, pure culture studies show they're very messy consumers. They'll chop down the polymer and they leave bits of carbohydrate, short chains, sometimes individual sugars. Could be due to catabolite regulation of metabolism. But anyway, it allows these other sugar utilizers to come in and do the fermentations. And then we get down to the syntrophs that grow on waste products of other bacteria. So this is a fermentation part of the diagram, starches and fiber. I put a little saccharide somewhere in the middle. These are the fermentation products. These are some of the examples of bacteria. But the interesting thing is this. There's relatively, this is phenotypic diversity. So you go from lots of different species here, getting down, and then when you get to the top, there's relatively few bacteria are involved in the de novo breakdown of complex macromolecules. But because they get first bite of the cherry, they're there in high numbers. And look at carbon and energy flow through the system, it's trickling down all the time from these primary polysaccharide degraders. So this is the final slide. I drew this up about 25 years ago. It was actually made from a sketch. I didn't draw it myself. I gave the sketch to a medical artist. And it summarizes more or less the previous slide. So this is the principal polysaccharide degraders. As I said, you get the first bite of the cherry. These are the little carbohydrate cross feeders who are just waiting for any crumbs that come down for them. These are the centrophic species, in this case an alcohol utilizer. And then we've got the gas utilizers, the acetogens, sulfur producers, and the methanogens. As I said, this was drawn up about 25 years ago. And I think in broad terms, we haven't really changed our view, at least the global view, of what's happening in terms of fermentation in the gut. That's it. Thank you very much for your attention, everyone.